poetry on the radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the first of two episodes with Anne M. Carson, plus The Rhyming Bugle, poetry news and events around Canberra. For ArtSound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles. Anne M. Carson is a Melbourne-based poet, visual artist and essayist. Her books include Massaging Himmler, a poetic biography of Dr. Felix Kirsten, Hybrid Publishers 2019, about a masseur who managed to free thousands of prisoners in Nazi Germany. She's a final year PhD candidate at RMIT, writing a poetic biography of George Sand. Along with winning several honours for her poetry, Anne M. Carson has mounted poetry-led social justice projects for such groups as the River Keepers, the Carbon Neutral Charity Fund, and Anti-Slavery Australia. Her most recent publication is The Detective's Chair, Liquid Amber Press, 2023. Poetry on the Radio's Kimberly K. Williams began by asking Anne M. Carson about her collection of prose poem portraits of fictional detectives and how detective work compares with poetic practice.
Well, this was a bit of a passion project, I have to say, and it came out of an inquiry I had about why do I read so much crime fiction? Isn't that a lowbrow thing to read? And I sort of felt like maybe I was wasting time, but I kept on doing it because I wanted to know, well, what's hooking me in? And it was a really great inquiry because what I came up with was the understanding that the detectives I really like solve crimes in a very similar manner to how I write poetry. So this opened up a whole new way of looking at crime fiction as creative problem solvers and as kin of mine, actually. So I chucked that lowbrow label right out in that process and really reclaimed it as, particularly the ones I like, an exploration of different ways of thinking, using intuition, using inklings, all the little sort of nudges and winks that life can give you about things. And these detectives that I've put in the book are people who do that, who listen to those little nudges and winks.
I love that because that is really part of the writing process, isn't it? It's having an idea, sure, but it's being able to follow the nudges and winks that come to you and you don't know why.
So the chair came about because when I was first thinking about this, most of the detectives I was reading sat in a chair at the end of the day, kicked up with a beverage of some kind and let their mind loose. And in that process, these ideas came to them. But when I went into it a bit further, I was questioning, why haven't I got any women here? I read female detectives. Why haven't I included them? And I realised it was because they seemed to confound my pattern. They didn't actually sit in a chair at the end of the day. They were too busy doing all the other things that a lot of women do, picking up the laundry, picking up the kids, taking their mother to the shopping. Mm-hmm. So I retained the idea of the chair, but for the women, it's often a symbolic chair. They still tune in, of course, to that nudging and winking that is part of being creative problem solvers, but they don't necessarily do it in the same way as the blokes.
No, they do it while they're hanging the wash.
On the run.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I think hanging the wash is very meditative.
So many domestic things can be if you're not feeling pressured.
Mm.
Ironing is a good one for me.
Mm. These are prose poems.
They're prose poems.
How did that come about?
I can't remember exactly why I went there, but they seemed to take that shape. And then I thought, okay, well, I'm going to standardise them so they're all right-hand justified, so they're not lineated in the way that so-called poems are. And I wanted them all to be 14 lines long to give a nod to the sonnet, to bring another element of poeticism into the mix. And I think that standardisation helped me because it was a regular container that I could sort of pour the thoughts into and enable that compression of working with material to happen within that container. I must say too that the book's been beautifully illustrated to bring out that idea of the receptivity of the space of the chair. The illustrator Renee Carrasco has done a series of fantastic illustrations, and it was so much fun working with him. I'd not worked with an illustrator before, and he really got into the swing of it and did these beautiful illustrations that really brings out something different with each one and also brings out the international flavour of the different detectives I've chosen. And this one is Vera Stanhope, who we all, many of us love from telly as well as the books, and hers is an office chair with a desk with many papers. Goshawk Moments is the name of the poem. Detective Chief Inspector, DCI, Vera Stanhope, Northumberland City Police, UK. Vera relishes being rude, follows well-worn paths through irony, directly into belligerence and beyond. Large of body, bulging nose, man-sized feet. As a child, said to be ugly as a bag of nails. She still lives in her childhood home where dark secrets ooze from nooks and crannies. Fleece vests worn with shapeless crimpline dresses, sandals, bare legs to help her raging eczema. Promoted, despite the code, only attractive men-pleasing women gain advancement. Pet, she says, shocking suspects into compliance. Always both iconoclastic and ethical, she has a solid reputation for results. Ghosts of the recent dead hover nearby, urging her on. Goshawk moments give her visions of the whole. She does her thinking in a chipped, scaled enamel bath, or in her desk chair in the office, which reminds her of a lavatory. Rocking back, thinking out loud before her Sergeant Joe, sometimes for his input, often casting him as audience.
What I love is all the physical details, the dress, and then even just the detail of leaving the legs bare for the raging eczema, but then setting the reader for the imaginative leap then that it takes with the recent dead hovering nearby. It gives a movement.
Great.
So, you know, these poems that are sort of really set into these poured containers, right, do so much. And I think that's what's so exciting about them.
They're exciting to write for that reason, really challenging. I feel like I set myself quite a challenge in the constraints that I had. Often we talk about constraints, don't we? And some people find that they work really well, and in this instance it was a creative element to have those constraints, and I did really like grounding it in actual detail, grounding this, as you say, imaginative leap in the detail of the person, particularly the quirky or the interesting or the not so pleasant sometimes.
When I was reading this poem, and you know, I was going through the book, just the first four words, Vera relishes being rude, I was in.
So true of her, isn't it? I think that's one of the reasons why she's so well loved, because she breaks that stereotype of the polite woman. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't do it in a horrible way. It's endearing somehow. She manages to do it without losing her humanity or capacity to connect to the victim's family. Yeah, she manages to sort of straddle both being rude and being adorable.
Right, but calling people pet.
Yeah, that's right.
And catching them off guard. One of the things I love too about the book, so just the little details, the illustrations are they pen and ink or?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Yes. So they're, I just thought to say that since people can't see it. But I love like the details. So Detective Warshawski, Chicago. And I love the detail that the steering wheel is on the left side in the illustration,
yes,
like it would be in the US. I mean, little details like that are just so right.
So, yes, the illustration is of an American car dashboard and just the front of the driver's seat. And the poem's called Keeping Her Gun Wrist Strong. Victoria Ifeanya Warshawski, private investigator, Chicago, USA. She packs pick locks, holsters her Smith & Wesson under an old windcheater, triple locks her apartment, creeps past her neighbour's door. 3 a.m., Chicago. Something's fishy in the senator's office. 3 hours to rifle files before workers arrive. Vic to her friends, Cookie and Doll to Sal, her 74 years young downstairs neighbour who joins her on stakeouts. To clients, it's V.I. Wachowski, P.I. Life on the dark side makes her cranky, distrustful, even of loved ones. A short fuse and plenty of lip don't help. Survival as a child was street fighting. Now her late mother Gabriella's manual, Olivetti, keeps her gun wrist strong. Not for her philosophizing. She fights against the bad guys and for women. The only time she spends in a chair is parked, panting, behind the wheel of a red Trans Am after a chase. At the end of a hard day, she likes whiskey, a bath for bruises and soreness, then to collapse into bed where nightmares rake her sleep.
In a way, what captivates me about this poem is it's actually rather gentle because it's third person, right? And it's talking about her, but she packs a Smith & Wesson. I mean, you know, so it's interesting that the approach to presenting her is a little bit soft, right? And it sort of counterbalances her not so soft presence.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I did feel, and I think when you read her, you feel compassion for her because, you know, she does this, she goes on stakeout, she's got her gun, you know, she's a tough dude. And her sleep is disturbed by nightmares.
Yeah.
So however tough she is, it gets to her.
It gets to her.
Yeah.
Exactly. When one reads this poem in the book, it's on page 67, and then you turn the page and you find this poem called Pocket of Contemplation, Anne M. Carson, Poet D.I. I was delighted to encounter this without realizing I would. Could you speak to it a little?
Yeah. And I really have to thank a dear friend, the late Geordie Alberston, for the idea for this poem, because she knew I was doing the project. And she said, you've got to do one for yourself. And it would never have occurred to me. But with her encouragement and knowing what a great experimental poet she was, mm-hmm. I just had the courage to try it. And I hope it works. The illustration here is with a tub chair and a whole lot of scrunched up bits of paper surrounding the chair.
On the floor.
On the floor, that's right. Pocket of Contemplation, Anne M. Carson, Poet D.I., Chelsea, Australia. Her chair is red, like her wine, capacious enough so she can curl cat-like in its folds. It's dusk, and the dead bodies of failed poems lie scattered around. She can't deal with bloody dismemberment just yet. Right now, she wants to follow where the new poem spore leads, quick on its heels to prevent escape. Later, engine throb throws her into reverie. She's pillion on the motorcycle, letting the world and all responsibility whiz past. The great clock stalls. A pocket of contemplation opens. Nothing is expected of her except presence. Speed awakens the kind of attention poems long for. Razor sharp, and rambling at the same time. Here she finds freedom, and in daily beach walks calibrated to waves' constancy and the far horizon's seductive call. Rarely found at desks foursquare, she likes life best when thoughts think her rather than the other way around. Without distraction, ideas flock.
That, I think, is the embodiment of how we started this conversation, where you're really showing that creative process that is like detecting, putting things together as a poet as well as a detective.
Yes, and I think one of the things that I really liked in this project was being able to embody that process. Mm. It is an embodied process, and I think so much theory now is reflecting that when we think, our body responds, our body is part of that, and anyway, it's a brain in a body. And I think a whole lot of research about the gut and the gut being a second brain is sort of maybe science backing up what people have felt, you know, for a long time. People feel things in their guts.
Right.
They feel things in the back of their neck. They feel things in little sort of shivers that go down their back. There are all sorts of ways that our thinking and our response to life is registered in the body. And so this work also is an exploration of that process.
In our Western culture, we're sort of invited to be disembodied, right? We, you know, everything needs to be fact-based and double-checked. And that's so important that you leave the gut behind, so to speak. And this is a great reminder of how whole we are, no matter what we endeavor to do.
That's great that you're reading it like that. I'd love to contribute to that process because I think we have become very disembodied. And I think a lot of technology contributes to that, a lot of desk-based work. I mean, computers are fantastic, don't get me wrong, but too much time with a computer and you do lose touch with your body and your body's needs. And I like the thought that this work might contribute in some minuscule way to that alert or that awareness about bodies.
Next, Kimberly K. Williams asked Anne M. Carson about how her poems about fictional detectives link to her other work, particularly her collection Massaging Himmler, a poetic biography of Dr. Felix Kirsten, Hybrid 2019, about a masseur who managed to free thousands of death-bound prisoners in Nazi Germany by manipulating the psychosomatic high Nazi official Heinrich Himmler.
In some ways, it seems, as I'm thinking about your larger body of work, and many of the books you've published, in some ways this seems a bit of a departure, topic-wise, but in other ways not so much, right? I mean, you've done the poetic biography of Dr. Felix Kirsten called Massaging Himmler. How I first came to your work was through your use of poetic biography, right, George Sand, which is what you're currently working mm-hmm. on. So in some ways, this is biography, but it's fictional.
Yeah, good observation. And also there's another link with Massaging Himmler, and that sort of takes me right back to becoming a poet, because at first I didn't think I was going to be a poet at all. I thought I was going to be a masseur. So I have that training in embodied healing modality.
Mm.
Many different kinds of experiences and trainings went into that. And I really didn't ever set up a practice, although I did do, you know, quite a bit of work. But I never set up a practice and became a professional masseur. And what happened was I found this, as I was training, as I was sort of on that journey to become a masseur, I found this book in an op shop, and it was called The Healing Touch. And it was an amazing story that I read in one night. It was a true story about a little known flawed humanitarian called Dr. Felix Kirsten, who had become the masseur of Heinrich Himmler during the Second World War. And he used his remarkable influence over Himmler. He massaged Himmler every day of the war, sometimes in multiple treatments. He was the only person who could even momentarily relieve this guy's incredible, what I call psychosomatic condition. And because he had such an influence, because Himmler was so grateful for this service, he was able to manipulate Himmler to release many thousands of prisoners, not just Jewish people, but lots of Jewish people. And so I got sort of diverted from my journey into becoming a masseur to become a writer. And I wanted to retell this story. And at first I thought it might be prose, but as life turned out, I actually became a poet and started writing it in verse. And it was a 22-year project. It took a long time. It was really hard to immerse myself in that horrible time and be witness to it, even though it itself is a positive story. It's set in that horrible time with so much suffering. So it was really hard to stick with it. I also wanted to honour the history, and I've included the history in Marginalia on the page that history is told in Marginalia down the side, and then the story of Kirsten himself and Himmler is told in poetry through the middle.
That's really one of my favourite things about this book is, for one thing, it's a long book. It's for a poetry book. It's quite long. So I imagined it took you a while, but 22 years was was a bigger number than I had anticipated. But studying the use of the whole page, you've got couplets for the poems, and then you oftentimes do use almost like footnotes, but to the side rather than at the bottom. And I wondered how you came to that, rather, you know, why not put all the notes at the back like many poets or even other prose writers would do?
I have to thank Geordie Elbiston again. She was my mentor. I had quite a few mentors at different points, and all of them really helped me refine this because, it was such a massive undertaking, so much information to get onto the page. How do you do it? And I started out by having notes, and I started out actually interspersing prose pieces with the poems. So I'd have the history in a prose piece, on the next page I'd have the poem. And it was Geordie that suggested, what about you reduce the font of the historical and really make a differentiation between what is the poem and that poetic story you're telling? And then it's really like you're contextualizing it in the frame of history.
And in the frame of the page.
And in the frame of the page, that's right, yeah. And so people can choose. You know, when you've got notes at the end of a book, sometimes it's really painful. You don't, as a reader, you don't want to turn the page to get to those notes.
It's true.
Down the bottom of a page, it can look really unsightly to have a big whack of information. This way, I chose it in the end because I felt, I thought it had an aesthetic appeal, actually, to have this framing, visual framing. And I thought, people don't have to read it. They can just read the poetry if they wish.
I do agree. It actually gives the reader a choice rather than a default because it's right there.
Mm.
But then the book also has other things right at the end. It has a lot of ancillary information, a glossary, works consulted, list of characters. So historically, it's a very broad book.
Yeah, and I could have just written the poetic story, but I felt a number of things. I felt this real obligation to history, and I was aware that this Holocaust story is, young people are not aware of it often. And so that was sort of ringing in my head, I wanted to keep that story alive, lest we ever do it again, sort of a warning. And then because I'd chosen to do it like that, I felt honour bound, because it's such contested territory, I wanted it to be really transparent. I wanted to sort of put down where I got everything, every little bit in the poem, so that if someone was so inclined, they could immediately see where claims came from or even little details. So I felt a real obligation like that too. And even before I undertook the project, when I knew I wanted to do it, I really wanted to check it with some survivors to see, I'm not Jewish, I'm a masseur. I've got a connection because I'm a training masseur, but I'm not Jewish. My family was never involved in the Holocaust. So I went to the Jewish Museum and spoke to the education officer there, and he was fantastic, and he was really willing to help me fulfill this ethical, what I perceived as an ethical obligation. And he got together a group of survivors for me to be able to say, I've got this story. What do you think? Is it okay for me to tell it? So I think there was about six people there, and three of them had heard of this guy, which was the most, I've never met anyone who had heard of him. So that was astounding. And three who hadn't. And they all said, absolutely, please tell the story. We want more people to know what this guy did, and the more knowledge, the better about how things panned out.
I had a question about the timing. So this was published in 2019, after 22 years. Was the book's success was it affected by COVID?
It was. Mm. It was really unfortunate. I was one of the lucky ones that I actually got to launch the book, and I had a remarkable synchronicity. I'd tried to contact the family over that 22 years. I'd done many things, even spoken to a private detective. You know, this is what I've done. What would you do? And she said, no, you've done everything you can from here. So I just relinquished that desire to be connected with the family. But right at the 11th hour, I got a phone call from this guy, and he said, oh, are you the person who's researching Dr. Kirsten? And I said, yes. And he said, I am too. And I'm just about to hop on a plane for Sweden because I'm a representative of the World Massage Congress. And I have an international posthumous award that I'm about to give to his son. And he said, I have to go. I'll ring you later. And left me totally. So eagerly awaited his call. And eventually that led to me setting up a travel fund and being able to bring out the son to launch the book. So in the end, there's an essay written by the son about his efforts to keep his father's memory and actions alive. It led to me visiting the home in Sweden, or outside of Sweden, in the countryside, and the uncanniness of looking at his father's library and seeing it was virtually a replica of my library that I'd got to research this book, and photos of his father and many objects of his father, like a little museum. I had that launch. You know, I was so lucky. I could bring the guy out. He did a beautiful job launching it. And then it died. COVID happened and it died. And I had quite a few things lined up, and some of those went ahead post-COVID, but many of them didn't, you know, and its time was gone. And, you know, that was very painful for me and the publisher. The publisher was Louis DeVries from Hybrid Books, and it was a passion project for him, being he and his wife, for being Jewish. Mm-hmm. And they really believed in the book and they went all out and they did such a superb job.
Next week, as we continue our discussion with Anne M. Carson, we'll hear her read the opening poem from Massaging Himmler, her poetic biography of the extraordinary masseur who freed thousands of prisoners of the Nazi atrocities. We'll also hear her talk about other projects, including her current one, a biography in poetry of the French writer George Sand. I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. That poetry thing at Smith's Alternative in Civic on Monday, September 11 at 7 p.m. will host a big open mic. Readers have 3 minutes each. And here's advance word that on September 25, Monday at Smith's, 7 p.m, The Book of Birds, an anthology of bird-related poems, edited by Leyland and Lebkowitz, will launch. We will also present the book on a forthcoming episode of this program, Poetry on the Radio. The Canberra Nara Sister City 30th Commemorative Anthology, Poetry Leaves, will launch on Saturday, September 23 at 1:30 p.m. at Generator Gallery at Belconnen Arts Centre. This month at Manning Clark House Poetry, on Thursday, 28 September at 7 p.m, Canberra-based poets Jen Crawford and Paul Collis and Melbourne-based Rose Lucas at the Manning Clark House, 11 Tasmania Circle in Forest. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded First Nations country in the studios of Art Sound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is Murray Pariah's interpretation of Johannes Brahms' Piano Sonata No. 3 in F minor. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.